This week's readings are from two of my favorite pieces, or three of my favorite pieces in Caribbean critical writing, B.S. Naipaul's The Middle Passage, 1962 travelogue memoir, and two essays by Derek Walcott, one his Nobel lecture, The Antilles, Fragments of Epic Memory, and The Muse of History, that was published, I think, a decade and a half prior to the Antilles. I really like them because, first of all, I think they're just wonderfully written, and they're two Nobel Prize winners, and there's no doubt about it when you read this prose. They write like no other. There's really something different about both of them and the way they write prose, and the way they write nonfiction. And so, but for me, so the key ideas in the pieces are for me really pivotal. And I use that word pivotal intentionally here to say that in the discussion between Naipaul and Walcott, or I should say the discussion, the critical confrontation between Naipaul and Walcott that Walcott initializes in his Nobel lecture, the Antilles essay, it really addresses the pivot point in Caribbean critical theory. And it's that critical, it's that, that pivot point in critical thinking about the meaning of colonialism. If we think about the trajectory of the materials so far in the course, and I want to set aside Sylvia Winter, because I do think Winter's theorizing is a slightly different case. But if we look at the early surrealist and negritude readings that we've discussed and that I've discussed in these process pieces, the negritude and surrealist movement had this sort of worked with this idea that there was some sort of trace element of whether it's ancestral meaning in the case of negritude and thinking about African civilization, or in terms of the senses in the body and its capacity to activate a different kind of imagination in the case of surrealism, there was this sense that something remained outside the reach of colonialism. And through the senses or through this sort of ancestral reactivation through traces of African civilization, we could arrive at a point of working outside the colonial system and its limits on the imagination. One of the really important innovations, and it's the troubling innovation of Fanon in Black Skin, White Masks, is his argument that, and I think it's quite convincing, right, in its elaborate detail, his claim, an argument that colonialism is a total system and actually leaves us with no resources, whether it's in the senses and body or in the ancestral imagination. And in that way, Fanon's challenge is really the challenge that Naipaul takes up in The Middle Passage. Naipaul and Fanon work in sync here. They are very different thinkers. Fanon is a revolutionary and optimistic, despite all of the pessimism that underlies a text like Black Skin, White Masks. But in the end, really, Fanon is like, we can begin again in this post-apocalyptic future where we end our relationship to the past and present. That's Fanonian thinking. What Naipaul is another iteration of that same diagnosis of colonialism broadly, but I think it's important to really just keep the scope of this conversation to the Caribbean with Naipaul, because that's really what he is describing, just like Fanon is. But what Naipaul is as a thinker and a writer is someone who theorizes from a position and stays in the position of deep melancholy. And I say melancholy in order to mark a distinction that Freud made between mourning and melancholia. That mourning is the act of sadness where we can identify the lost object. And we do through mourning processes, whatever they are, whether they are religious or secular rituals, or our own emotional work or therapeutic work. And, you know, since Freud is a psychotherapist, we work through those feelings of loss because we can identify the object and find ways to direct the energies that attend to that object toward another kind of object and move out of that position of sadness. What makes the melancholic melancholic is this conception of a description that Freud gives of melancholia, which is as a sadness and despair where you can't identify the object. You can't actually identify the thing that has been lost. And without that ability to identify that thing that has been lost, the melancholic is sad without a sort of horizon, natural horizon of healing, right? And processing. So what you end up in the case of melancholics is perhaps by fiat, a sort of cure appears, right? Or not a cure, even an overcoming appears. But no one really knows why, and no one really knows how to activate that. And Naipaul, as a nonfiction and fiction writer, is a deeply melancholic thinker. For him, one of the ways that's expressed in his fiction is through writing fiction of the deepest kind of homelessness imaginable. So you have, say, in maybe his best known novel, A House for Mr. Biswas, a story about someone who is trying to care for and cultivate this home in a place that is decrepit, falling apart. And so there's this, I don't know what you want to call it, if it's like a lack of awareness, or I think more for Naipaul, a sense in which you go on despite the impossibility of going on, where the house is falling apart as it is fixed. It's made of rotted materials. It's a place that has no place, that has no connection to place, that has no way of anchoring a sense of identity and reality on the foundations, literally because it is a house, but also figuratively the foundations of the land and landscape. In this case, it's important to note, you know, that Naipaul is Indo-Caribbean, descendant of people who survived the Kalapani, which is the term for the description of the transport of indentured forced laborers from India to Trinidad and other parts of the Caribbean, but largely in Trinidad. And so for him, his works often explore, like House for Mr. Biswas does, explore this idea of not having any place to call your own, whether it's the colony, Trinidad, or India, the ancestral homeland, or England, the colonial homeland. None of these places are home. And so that sense of homelessness without, again, this is the melancholic part, without an object of the lost home to which you could attach your sadness and therefore work through in some significant way. Without that, you are just, there is just sadness. There is just a sense of loss. There is just a sense of an abyss at the heart of one's own being and of collective being. A really, my favorite actually of his novels is Bend in the River, which is about a descendant again of Indian forced and indentured laborers in Uganda. And a lot of that novel, it can be very difficult to read because the Africans are depicted as completely opaque and foreign and distant and incomprehensible. For some readers, that's meant looking at that novel and wondering, you know, is this a sort of racist depiction of the uninterpretable African? But I really think that misunderstands melancholia in V.S. Naipaul's work broadly, which is if we think about the melancholia of the forced migrant who has no home in Uganda, in India, or in England, or in any other colonial place, then everything is foreign, everything is inaccessible. And one has, you know, at most, completely fleeting relationships. Now, how is that literature grounded conceptually is the question that I ask. And that's why these bits and pieces from the Middle Passage are so important to me. Because what we get in the travelogue work by Naipaul is this accounting of how an accounting of the landscape and historical meaning of colonial places, in particular the Caribbean. So the subtitle of the middle passage is The Caribbean Revisited. So it's purely a book about the Caribbean. And there's that famous passage, or it's, you know, famous in these tiny circles of Caribbean theory, where he says, you know, nothing was created in the Caribbean or in the West Indies. But he also says, you know, history is a story of creation, of what has been created. So when he says that, on the one hand, a number of critics, because Naipaul is both one of the most important writers of the 20th century in the English language and also one of the most criticized. So it's hard to find people who read Naipaul broadly and expansively, honestly. But when he says that, part of what it triggers in critics is this response of, and it's a thoughtful response, that, you know, things are created in the Caribbean, and then point to all of these cultural forms that perhaps everyone listening to this and everyone in the class can kind of name offhand. But it is important to me to take this back, this text back to 1962, and also understand that this is essentially the same conception of the Caribbean that Frantz Fanon had. Although Fanon's a revolutionary, Naipaul's a melancholic, they have the same portrait of the Caribbean, which is this place in which there is nothing other than what colonialism created. And that is not a wild claim. That is not a claim that comes out of nowhere. Because absolutely, we can talk about cultural formation over the last 50 years, but the Caribbean itself is a landscape of genocide of indigenous peoples and repopulation of the islands by enslaved Africans who, when enslaved, had the entirety of their Africanness taken from them as a matter of colonial design, practice, and intention. And the intention was always to sever displaced and forcibly migrated, then enslaved Africans, to displace them from all of their cultural forms, right? To take that relationship away. And so what you have in the Caribbean is a world created by colonialism, which means created from abroad, created from the colonizer, of course, but also from the colonized, right? That they themselves as arrivants arrive empty, right? Arrive through the brutal force of colonialism, arrive without the substance of their culture. And so what is in the Caribbean is something that is created not in the Caribbean, but created by the act of colonialism. It's a very difficult insight. I don't think it's difficult to grasp, right? So what I'm saying, I'm repeating myself, but I think it's actually quite intuitive and straightforward. However, the way Naipaul puts it there is something that has always upset readers, or I should say has upset readers over the last like 40 or 50 years. I think at the time it, you know, this is a, you know, 1962. And so it's really, you know, very little independence work in the Caribbean, you know, and the strong presence still of all the colonial forces at the cultural and political levels. So when Fanon and Naipaul are reckoning with this, you know, Naipaul writing this just a year after Fanon passes, very much in the same vein, they really are talking about something that cannot and has not been created in the Caribbean because of the history of the region. And that, while maybe dispiriting and open to critique, is not itself an ungrounded or impossible to understand or comprehend or even contemplate assessment. I mean, I think we are presentist if we reject that. But also, we run the risk, if we reject Naipaul's claims outright, we run the risk of really underestimating the comprehensive power of colonialism. And by comprehensive power, I mean that in the way that Fanon talked about it. It occupies everything from our desires to our language to our sense of subjectivity to our sense of a political and cultural destiny. But we can see in the Antilles lecture from Walcott, exactly the relationship between Naipaul and Walcott. They were very much rivals, and some of that rivalry has to do with who's the greatest Caribbean writer, and they're two men. And so there's a lot of one-upsmanship, of course. And there's no small part of that going on in the Antilles essay. But in Antilles essay, I think I mentioned before, was Walcott's Nobel Prize lecture. So he receives a prize and every prize winner gives a lecture, and that's the Antilles essay. And so when, you know, when he takes on Naipaul in the Antilles, he takes on Naipaul's ideas with real substance that those ideas have inside them. And I appreciate that about Walcott, because Walcott could just as easily have said, you know, we don't have time for this melancholic. Instead, I think what's important for me about Walcott reckoning with Naipaul is that he, first of all, goes to Trinidad. And Walcott is not Trini. He's from St. Lucia. So he's from a completely different island with a completely different history than Trinidad. Also, Walcott is Afro-Caribbean. He's not Indo-Caribbean. But when he talks about Felicity in some of the most beautiful passages I think you will ever find in a nonfiction piece, when he talks about Felicity and he sees this festival, it's a Hindu festival. And this is so important because there's nothing in Walcott's own history, whether where he's from or his own ancestry, that would make him turn to the Hindu festival as a site for contemplation. I think it's because he's trying to address Naipaul, and he's trying to say, look, on the one hand, maybe there's been this rivalry between Walcott and Naipaul, and they are very different kinds of thinkers and take their ideas in very different directions. But what Naipaul is describing is even inside Walcott, because there's that moment where Walcott says, you know, I looked out at these revelers at the festival and I thought, oh, they're evoking lost India. And in that moment where he says they're evoking lost India, he follows Naipaul down a path. Naipaul takes the next step, right? And says, if that's an evocation of lost India, it's lost forever. They are actually engaging in this mythic activity and connecting to something that they don't actually have a connection to, right? And so he would see it as a kind of false mourning, right? And a sign of melancholia, that they can't find anything to attach this colonial sadness to. But Walcott takes that next step and asks himself, why would I think that it was an evocation of lost India? What if it was instead a combination of all these forces that make Trinidad, Trinidad, right? And he mentions, you know, the Middle Eastern, the Indian, the East Asian, the African, and, you know, all of the colonial powers. All of those elements are there in this festival. And he says, you know, basically asks us and says that he himself shifts perspective and so wants us to do the same, asks us to see this festival as, for lack of a better way of putting it, a Trinidad festival, a Caribbean festival. And in that, it does not derive its meaning from its ability to properly, robustly, or accurately evoke an ancestral past. Rather, what it is its own event. Well, how do we imagine that event? Well, how we imagine that event, I think, is so perfectly put. And this is why poets and novelists should always write nonfiction. They always just have a moment where we need a metaphor. We need an image that will stay with us. And the image that has stayed with Caribbean theory and Caribbean poetics broadly, is that image of the vase. He says, you know, what colonialism did was broke the vase. This idea that we, meaning Caribbeans, are a whole people is gone. It's shattered to pieces. Colonialism and enslavement and indentured servitude, in the case of Indo-Caribbeans, these are, you know, these shatter, you know, immediately, but certainly across generations, shatter a people. But how do we think about that shattering? Do we think that shattering in terms of the melancholia of a Naipaul, or this sort of radical, kind of unprompted, out of nowhere optimism of a Fanon? Or do we do something else with our with these shards, right? And that's with the vase. He says, you know, we put it back together, and it is more beautiful than it was in its original form. It's held together by these, you know, by the glue, the white glue that you can see the cracks and breaks in it, but the vase has its own beauty when reassembled. And so against Naipaul, Walcott does not offer some ancestral past, or remember, you can evoke lost India, or Walcott can evoke lost Africa. Instead, he says, you know, we are broken by colonialism. But the thing about broken things is that you can put them back together. And now we have to ask ourselves a question: what does it mean to put something back together? How do we think about this thing we put back together? Is it a sad remnant and bad memory of what was whole, or does it have its own kind of beauty? Obviously, Walcott moves in the direction. He affirms the latter, right? That it is its own kind of beauty. Now, I'll just say this last piece and then end this so it doesn't go on too long. This is why the Muse of History essay is so interesting to me. Because one of the things that essay does, and that's from 1974, so, you know, sort of between the Middle Passage and the Antilles essay. So just in terms of sequence, I think that's super interesting. But when he ends the essay and he repudiates the idea of paternity, he says, you know, to the white father who bought me and to the African or black father who sold me, my ancestors, into slavery, he's like, I don't want you as fathers, right? You are not my fathers. I'm not trying to forgive you. I'm not trying to criticize you. I'm trying to live and affirm a completely different kind of life. So that idea of confirming and affirming a different kind of life is that moment where Walcott's like, look, there's history with a capital H, this grand narrative, right? And that grand narrative will always ask us to look to and root ourselves in some ancestral form, right? The white father or the black father, right? Europe, which is colonial alienation, or Africa, which is not only a sort of cultural alienation for Walcott, but also its own kind of disrespect to the enslaved ancestors who were sold into slavery by these people, right? By the ancestors of those, the black father, right? Is the African father is the father who sold Walcott's ancestors into slavery. And so it's like, you know, when we're asked to identify who and what we are according to that grand narrative of history that would link it to continents of Europe or Africa, we disrespect the experience of colonialism, the beauties that are possible in the fragments it leaves behind of all the broken pieces. But we also fail to see that there's a new kind of personhood or subjectivity or idea of what it means to be and to know that has emerged out of these centuries of enslavement and colonialism that don't need the continental father, that don't need a history with a capital H, but need history with a small H, right? And here, although Walcott is writing and thinking in English, it, you know, the French histoire is really helpful because histoire is about, you know, is has that double meaning of storytelling or stories and history, right? So that idea that you can tell stories about small places, Trinidad, Saint Lucia, Martinique, and you tell those stories on their own terms, and you don't measure them by some epic mythic history with a capital H. And once, as the Muse of History tries to argue, once we liberate ourselves from the need and desire to tell histories at that epic level, at that level of myth and continental ancestry in Africa or Europe, once we eschew that and start to embrace the stories of small places, all of a sudden we start to see what Naipaul thought was nothing was created here. And history is only a history of what was created. It limits Naipaul and Fanon and so many others, limits that idea of what history is to the colonial vision of history, which is this epic, mythic, deep set roots in continents. But if we decolonize and move away from the idea that the colonizer's idea of what history is the only idea of history, and start to ask, how do history and stories help make sense of the Caribbean experience? We move towards Walcott's notion of the vase, towards his observation of the Ramlila Festival, right? To say, like, this is not an evocation of olden places. These fragments do not need to be reassembled so that they look exactly like their ancestral past, but rather the way we put worlds together over here in the Caribbean, in pieces that are broken, and we seam them together. It might be, as he says at the end of the Muse of History, seamed by bitter juices, right? That idea that this is embittering work, but it's also real work. It's also work that has such depth and substance to it that it tells plenty of a story, that it makes sense in a really rigorous and deep way of why, despite the colonial past, there is this sense that Caribbean life is meaningful on its own terms. But in order to think about why Caribbean life is meaningful on its own terms, one has to change the relationship between history and the imagination. Change it, that is, to say, you know, we're going to rethink history and the imagination, moving away from this idea that the imagination must always connect with an epic or mythic history of a continent, and instead think about how to imagine the stories of small places, where it's important that he's talking about Trinidad, and not even Trinidad, but Felicity. He's rooted in a very small place, one event, and drawing from that a lesson for other places, but also drawing that lesson only about Felicity and asking in some sense to his fellow Caribbeans, you know, what is your, and for him, what is my Felicity? Where have we reassembled fragments to make something beautiful out of our lives? And what would it mean to understand Caribbean life, Caribbean culture, Caribbean history on that model of fragments reassembled by the work of love? What does a Caribbean look like? And what would it mean to even say, against Naipaul, something was created here?